but the thousands, right? So Jimmy gets on TV to do one of his spots, and he says, "My fellow Americans, the day the Russians get ahead of us in the arms race will be the day the youth of America shits red." Big laugh from the audience. So Ronnie gets on the phone to Jimmy, and he says, "Mr. President, what did Amy have for breakfast?" A gigantic laugh from the audience. Carlin pauses. The real punchline is then delivered in a low, insinuating tone. "Nope, nothing wrong here." The audience roars its approval, applauds wildly. Carlin shakes his head sadly. "Red shit, man. Wow, dig on it a while." That was the problem. George Carlin was the problem. Bob Hope was the problem. Johnny Carson was the problem. Steve Martin was the problem. Every barbershop wit in America was the problem. And then consider this. Sharp stock had gone down 9, and it only rebounded 4.25. The shareholders were going to be hollering for somebody's head. Let's see, whose do we give them? Who had the bright idea of the Sharp cereal professor in the first place? How about those guys as the most eligible? Never mind the fact that the professor had been on for 4 years before the Zingers debacle. Never mind the fact that when the Sharp cereal professor and his cohorts, the Cookie Sharpshooter and George and Gracie, had come on the scene, Sharp stock had been 3.25 points lower than it was now. Never mind all that. Mind this instead. Just the fact. Just the public announcement in the trades that AdWorks had lost the Sharp account. Just that would probably cause shares to bob up another 1.5 to 2 points. And when a new ad campaign actually began, investors would take it as a sign that the old woes were finally behind the company and the stock might creep up another point. Of course, Vic thought, stirring sweet and low into his coffee, that was only theory. And even if the theory turned out to be true, both he and Roger believed that a short-run gain for Sharp would be more than offset if a new ad campaign hastily thrown together by people who didn't know the Sharp company as he and Roger did, or the competitive cereal market in general, didn't do the job. And suddenly, that new slant, that fresh angle, popped into his mind. It came unbidden and unexpected. His coffee cup paused halfway to his mouth, and his eyes widened. In his mind, he saw two men, perhaps him and Roger, perhaps old man Sharp and his aging kid, filling in a grave. Their spades were flying. A lantern flickered fitfully in the windy night. Rain was drizzling down. These corporate sextons threw an occasional furtive glance behind them. It was a burial by night, a covert act performed in the darkness. They were burying the Sharp cereal professor in secret, and that was wrong. "Wrong," he muttered aloud. Sure it was, because if they buried him in the dead of night, he could never say what he had to say, that he was sorry. He took his Pentel pen from his inner coat pocket, took a napkin from the holder, and wrote swiftly across it, "The Sharp cereal professor needs to apologize." He looked at it. The letters were getting larger, fuzzing as the ink sank into the napkin. Below that first sentence, he added, "Decent burial." And below that, "Daylight burial." He still wasn't sure what it meant. It was more metaphor than sense, but that was how his best ideas came to him, and there was something there. He felt sure of it. Cujo lay on the floor of the garage in semi-gloom. It was hot in here, but it was even worse outside. And the daylight outside was too bright. It never had been before. In fact, he had never even really noticed the quality of the light before. But he was noticing now. Cujo's head hurt. His muscles hurt. The bright light made his eyes hurt. He was hot. And his muzzle still ached where he had been scratched. Ached and festered. The man was gone somewhere. Not long after he left, the boy and the woman had gone somewhere, leaving him alone. The boy had put a big dish of food out for Cujo, and Cujo had eaten a little bit. The food made him feel worse instead of better, and he left the rest of it alone. Now there was the growl of a truck turning into the driveway. Cujo got up and went to the barn door, knowing already it was a stranger. He knew the sound of both the man's truck and the family car. He stood in the doorway, head poking out into the bright glare that hurt his eyes. The truck backed up the driveway and then stopped. Two men got down from the cab and came around to the back. One of them ran up the truck's sliding back door. The rattling, banging noise hurt Cujo's ears. He whined and retreated back into the comforting gloom. The truck was from Portland Machine. 3 hours ago, Charity Camber and her still dazzled son had gone into Portland Machine's main office on Brighton Avenue, and she had written a personal check for a new Jorgen chainfall. Wholesale had turned out to be exactly $1,241.71, tax included. Before going to Portland Machine, she had gone into the state liquor store on Congress Street to fill out a lottery claim form. Brett, forbidden absolutely to come inside with her, stood on the sidewalk with his hands in his pockets. The clerk told Charity she would get a lottery commission check in the mail. How long? 2 weeks at the very outside. It would come minus the deduction of roughly $800 for taxes. This sum was based on her declaration of Joe's yearly income. The deduction for taxes before the fact did not anger Charity at all. Up until the moment when the clerk had checked her number against his sheet, she had been holding her breath, still unable to believe this had really happened to her. Then the clerk had nodded, congratulated her, and even called the manager out of his office to meet her. None of that mattered. What mattered was that now she could breathe again, and the ticket was no longer her responsibility. It had returned to the bowels of the lottery commission. Her check would be in the mail. Wonderful, mystical, talismanic phrase. And still, she felt a small pang as she watched the dog-eared ticket, limp with her own nervous perspiration, clipped to the form she had filled out, and then stored away. Lady Luck had singled her out. For the first time in her life, maybe for the only time, that heavy muslin drape of the everyday had been twitched a little, showing her a bright and shining world beyond. She was a practical woman, and in her heart she knew that she hated her husband more than a little, and feared him more than a little, but that they would grow old together, and he would die, leaving her with his debts, and this she would not admit for sure, even in her secret heart, but now she feared it, perhaps with his spoilt son. If her name had been plucked from the big drum in the twice-yearly super drawing, if she had won 10 times the $5,000 she had won, she might have entertained notions of pushing aside that dull muslin curtain, taking her son by the hand, and leading them both out into whatever was beyond Town Road Number 3 in Camber's Garage, foreign cars are specialty, and Castle Rock. She might have taken Brett to Connecticut with the express purpose of asking her sister how much a small apartment in Stratford would cost. But it had only been a twitch of the curtain. That was all. She had seen Lady Luck for a brief, bare moment, as wonderful, puzzling, and inexplicable as a bright fairy dancing under mushrooms in the dewy light of dawn, seen once, never again. So she felt a pang when the ticket disappeared from her view, even though it had robbed her sleep. She understood that she would buy a lottery ticket a week for the rest of her life and never win more than $2 all at once. Never mind, you don't count teeth in a gift horse, not if you were smart. They went out to Portland Machine, and she had written the check, reminding herself to stop at the bank on their way home and transfer enough money from savings to checking so that the check wouldn't bounce. She and Joe had a little over $4,000 in their savings account after 15 years, just about enough to cover 3/4 of their outstanding debts if you excluded the mortgage on the farm. She had no right to exclude that, of course, but she always did. She could not bring herself to think about the mortgage, except payment by payment. But they could dent the savings all they wanted to now, and then deposit the lottery commission check in that account when it came. All they would be losing was 2 weeks' interest. The man from Portland Machine, Louis Belasco, said he would have the chainfall delivered that very afternoon, and he was as good as his word. Joe Magruder and Ronnie Dubay got the chainfall on the truck's pneumatic step loader, and it whooshed gently down to the dirt driveway on a sigh of air. "Pretty big order for old Joe Camber," Ronnie said. Magruder nodded. "Put it in the barn," his wife said. "That's his garage." "Better get a good hold, Ronnie. This is a heavy whore." Joe Magruder got his hold, Ronnie got his, and puffing and grunting, the two of them half walked it, half carried it into the barn. "Let's sit it down a minute," Ronnie managed. "I can't see where the hell I'm going. Let's get used to the dark before we go ass over cowcatcher." They set the chainfall down with a thump. After the bright afternoon glare outside, Joe was mostly blinded. He could only make out the vague shapes of things, a car up on jacks, a workbench, a sense of beams going up to a loft. This thing ought... Ronnie began, and then stopped abruptly. Coming out of the darkness, from beyond the front end of the jacked-up car, was a low, guttural growling. Ronnie felt the sweat he had worked up suddenly turn clammy. The hairs on the back of his neck stirred. "Holy crow, do you hear that?" Magruder whispered. Ronnie could see Joe now. Joe's eyes were big and scared-looking.
"I hear it."
It was a sound as low as a powerful outboard engine idling. Ronnie knew it took a big dog to make a sound like that. And when a big dog did, it more often than not meant business. He hadn't seen a beware of dog sign when they drove up, but sometimes these bumpkins from the boonies didn't bother with one. He knew one thing. He hoped to God that the dog making that sound was chained up.
"Joe, you ever been out here before?"
"Once. It's a St. Bernard, big as a fucking house.
He didn't do that before."
Joe gulped. Ronnie heard something in his throat click.
"Oh, God. Look at there, Ronnie."
Ronnie's eyes had come partway to adjusting, and his half-sight lent what he was seeing a spectral, almost supernatural, cast. He knew you never showed a mean dog your fear. They could smell it coming off you. But he began to shudder helplessly anyway. He couldn't help it. The dog was a monster. It was standing deep in the barn, beyond the jacked-up car. It was a St. Bernard for sure. There was no mistaking the heavy coat, tawny even in the shadows, the breadth of shoulder. Its head was down. Its eyes glared at them with steady, sunken animosity. It wasn't on a chain.
"Back up slow," Joe said. "Don't run, for Christ's sake."
They began to back up, and as they did, the dog began to walk slowly forward. It was a stiff walk. Not really a walk at all, Ronnie thought. It was a stalk. That dog wasn't fucking around. Its engine was running, and it was ready to go. Its head remained low. That growl never changed pitch. It took a step forward for every step they took back. For Joe Magruder, the worst moment came when they backed into the bright sunlight again. It dazzled him, blinded him. He could no longer see the dog. If it came for him now... Reaching behind him, he felt the side of the truck. That was enough to break his nerve. He bolted for the cab. End of side two. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.